Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. This is the day we bring back our Meet the Professor series on chronic lymphocytic leukemia with Dr. Matt Davids from the Division of Lymphoma and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. We have several other investigators who will participate in this series, and we're going to show you a survey we did of these investigators later on in the program. Today, we're here to talk about CLL, something that is quite common in clinical practice, and I really have a warm spot for CLL because it was really CLL that we started doing these mini case presentations, of which at this point we've done more than 4,000 in every different kind of tumor since the beginning of the pandemic. And we're going to do a bunch of those more today here with CLL. As in all our programs, we will be talking about non-FDA approved uses of agents and regimens. So check out the package for more information. So here are the general medical oncologists and community-based practice who are going to be presenting cases to us. And Matt, we were going to start out with this kind of maybe interesting topic of an observation I made. So actually last week I met with three of these docs. Spencer was part of our group. We have like another 100 cases we recorded. We haven't even presented. We've already presented a couple hundred cases this way. But Warren, Tina, and Eric, I all worked with last week, spent about an hour and a quarter with each one of them. They presented each 10 cases to me. We're doing three of these programs, so I picked out a few of them today. We'll do some on the other. And we asked them for a bunch of different scenarios, and I was expecting to hear something, and I didn't hear it at all. And that's what I want to start out with you. Before we get into the cases they are presenting, I want to tell you about the cases they didn't present and ask you why. Because one of the things we said is, can you present a patient who's double refractory, you know, refractory to BTKA or refractory to venetoclax/obinutuzumab? They didn't have any, zero current cases. Not only that, they didn't have any current cases of transformation, which we're going to talk about later. So, you know, I was kind of hearkening back to one of the first interviews I did with Dr. Kantarjian. I think it was about 15 years ago when I think BTK was just getting warmed up, you know, just the beginning to talk about it. And he made that interesting statement. He thought maybe CLL was going to become the new CLL. And we just did a program about a week or so ago, a couple of weeks ago on CML. You know, asciminib, new TKIs, you know, new things about, you know, managing patients off therapy. I mean, they're in a whole other world. We spent 2.5 hours there. We didn't even cover everything in CML. But I want to ask you whether or not CLL really is following Dr. Kantarjian's prophecy, particularly from the point of view of, you know, advanced disease, double refractory, people dying of CLL. I hear cases like that from investigators, and I'm wondering why I didn't hear from these three people. And I was wondering, do you think it's because you guys got the targeted drugs first and you have patients who have been on them longer and they haven't quite got to that, but maybe are going to get to that? Or do you think that we're just curing CLL?
Well, first, thanks, Neil, for having me for some afternoon edutainment. It's always great to be with you. And I would say there's a number of factors at play here. You know, I think from our perspective in academia, we are seeing a lot of these patients probably because they're being referred in to see us. But it is true, I think, for any individual community practitioner, they may not see as much in the way of these double refractory cases. And it reminds me actually of where we were in the academic centers about 5 or 6 years ago when the targeted therapies had recently rolled out. We were using them for the first time. So there was sort of this honeymoon period where patients just did really well on one, and if they progressed, we'd switch them to the other. So none of these treatments are curative for CLL as far as we can tell. And so unfortunately, I do think it's coming. I think in the community, they'll be seeing more of these cases soon.
It does seem like we're getting a lot more out of BTK inhibitors, of venetoclax, of CD20. We're going to talk about maybe a big move that's coming. But yeah, I was thinking the same thing because there were several years when we would talk about CLL. And I remember one time, I think I saw a picture of it, one of the pictures of before it came on, Brad Call. I remember saying, Brad, you know, if you had CLL, what would you want to be treated with? And he took like a really long breath and sort of kind of mumbled ibrutinib, you know, before I even heard of it. So I think you guys knew it was coming. And here we are now. We have another BTK inhibitor, pirtobrutinib. And again, no experience. You know, we have two ADCs and a targeted therapy approved in metastatic bladder. I've talked on College Avenue, used any of this, at least of the two drugs. So pirtobrutinib, none of these three docs have used it, either in CLL or mantle cell. And they all asked me about it. Here's an example of the questions I got.
What is the best setting to use pirtobrutinib or to consider pirtobrutinib? You know, when should we be thinking about it, at least in the community? And what are, you know, the benefits of pirtobrutinib over the other BTK inhibitors? I'm definitely interested in knowing what the current approach is to managing patients who do progress after, you know, BTK inhibition, after getting a venetoclax-based regimen. You know, do people reach for pirtobrutinib first, or are they referring for CAR-T? Is it the same time frame that it takes for other CAR-T products to, you know, actually, like, logistically, how does that work out with the CAR-Ts if there's certain toxicities that would make one lean towards one versus the other?
So give us a little primer on pirtobrutinib today. And as we go through this, we'll talk about where it's heading.
So as you know, we have three different covalent BTK inhibitors approved for CLL, ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, and zanubrutinib. So I do like to make the point that covalent inhibitors are more similar than they are different. But pirtobrutinib is a non-covalent BTK inhibitor. Why does that matter? Well, it can actually target wild type and mutant BTK, particularly those mutations that can arise in patients on covalent BTK inhibitors. So that's one of the major differences with pirtobrutinib, is that it is very active in that resistant population. The other thing is that pirtobrutinib is the most selective of the BTK inhibitors, so it tends to be very well tolerated, very few off-target effects. So to answer her question, I do tend to think about pirtobrutinib on label, which would be in that double refractory population, post-covalent BTKI, post-venetoclax. Although, interestingly, in the NCCN guidelines, pirtobrutinib is also mentioned as a possibility as a second-line therapy for patients who have progressed on a covalent BTK inhibitor. And so you can imagine a situation, for example, a patient who might not be able to go through a venetoclax ramp-up for whatever reason, where you might start with a covalent BTK inhibitor frontline and then move to pirtobrutinib in the second-line setting.
We had a case, as I mentioned, we had so many cases of CLL presented, particularly during the pandemic. I remember we had a case of this patient with horrible heart disease. They had an implanted defibrillator, and they wanted to give the patient a BTK, and they said, what do we know about pirtobrutinib? Of course, obviously, we don't have much data in first line, or hardly any, but what do we know about cardiac effects, particularly compared to Cal and Zanu?
So we don't have any comparative data yet of pirtobrutinib versus covalent inhibitors. There is an ongoing randomized phase 3 trial comparing pirtobrutinib head-to-head to ibrutinib. So that will be very informative eventually. For now, we can kind of compare across studies, and the rates of some of these cardiovascular toxicities like AFib and hypertension do appear to be a bit lower with pirtobrutinib, even as compared with the more selective covalent inhibitors like acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib. Although, again, I'm cautious there because we don't have head-to-head data.
So let's take a look at some of the slides from the survey we did. We said, what third-line therapy do you use, double refractory disease? Pretty much everybody says pirtobrutinib, a CAR-T, also a consideration. We asked, you know, indirectly the same question we just asked you to your colleagues in terms of efficacy and tolerability compared to second generation. And most people are not sure about efficacy at this point, whether it maybe could be more efficacious, but a lot of people thinking it has greater tolerability. What about some of the, you know, problematic issues like arthralgias and skin problems? We see less of that also?
It appears to be a bit less, and it, you know, even though it does still occur, the grading, I think, is a little bit less. So maybe a little bit milder arthralgias if you see them, and milder rash. So it's generally a very well-tolerated drug.
I always see analogies to other situations. I don't know, it just pops into my head. I was thinking about when osimertinib came out in EGFR lung cancer, and, you know, it displaced the first generation. But then we saw, you know, we'll talk about mutations that occur on pirtobrutinib. It's always good to see what happens in the real world. We have this little trick we do, which is say, talk about the last patient in your practice who got pirtobrutinib. And my eyes go all the way to the right, that almost all these people had a prior BTK. And then it goes to the middle where I see PR right down the line. Can you comment on your experience, particularly with these patients that respond after prior BTK? Usually have they responded to the prior BTK, then they relapse, and then they respond again?
Yeah, that's right. So usually they've done well on their prior BTK inhibitor, often for several years, maybe 4, 5, 6 years on ibrutinib. But then eventually they begin to progress and you start them on pirtobrutinib. And it's really a very rapid response. These patients usually start feeling better almost right away. Lymph nodes begin to shrink back down. The counts improve. So the initial activity of pirtobrutinib is very quick and very profound. But we do find that especially for the double refractory patients, eventually as you get about a year and a half into pirtobrutinib, they do begin to start to show signs of progression. And that was what happened with my patient here. Did great for a little over a year and then began to have progressive disease.
So yeah, 15 months. What happened? What did you do when he progressed?
This was a patient who then went on to a clinical trial actually of a BTK degrader drug, which is yet another way to target BTK, which is not yet approved, but an interesting strategy. I know it's being explored in other cancers as well.
Yeah, we're doing a whole program on estrogen receptor degraders, and they have them in prostate as well. We're doing a whole program on that later this week, as a matter of fact. Is he responding incidentally to the degrader?
He is actually, yeah. He's responding nicely.
Wow.
We don't know about durability yet, but yeah, the early studies suggest about 80% of patients are responding to these BTK degraders, and a lot of them are post-pirtobrutinib.
Really fascinating. Of course, we saw last December approval of pirtobrutinib in CLL after it had been previously approved in mantle cell. I was so frustrated when I saw it approved in mantle cell. I'm like, where's the CLL approval? You guys are telling me all these great stories. We had to wait a while to see it, but finally it got here, and yet I don't know if the docs in practice are even using it yet because they haven't started to see these patients, but it sounds like maybe they could be coming soon. Here's the New England Journal, a big New England Journal paper. Always love seeing waterfall plots there, and you can see a lot of these patients had prior BTK. We talked about the responses that are seen and the ones you've seen in your patients. PFS, median of 19.6. Also a difference whether or not they'd had prior BCL2, any comments on that?
Yeah, I think this is a really important graph here because that median PFS of 16.8 months, just to put that in context, there's been series recently published on these double refractory patients treated with more historical agents. The median overall survival is in the range of only 5 months. So to see a median PFS here of close to 17 months is a really profound difference, and it's a great new option for our patients.
So, of course, everybody wants to know where it's heading. Here's one trial, CLL-321, pirtobrutinib against investigator's choice of therapy, but it looks like it's sort of non-BTK type therapy. Any predictions about what we're going to see and what it's going to mean?
Yeah, I mean, in this relapsed population, we don't really expect great activity from bendamustine and rituximab, even in the chemo-naive population. And then we know that with idelalisib, even though it's a very active agent, it does have some significant toxicities. So I think this is very likely to be a positive study favoring pirtobrutinib, and this is their registrational approach for monotherapy in the relapsed refractory setting. So I think this is likely to lead to full approval of the drug in CLL.
And here's another phase 3 trial in relapsed disease, looking at with venetoclax, rituximab, and again, Reese's relapse disease. Any thoughts about first-line therapy? And you know, we're going to talk about BTK plus venetoclax plus or minus CD20. That's what I think maybe is going to be the new standard of care after this coming ASH. This looks like kind of maybe a prelude to that. Do you think that strategy is going to be looked at first-line, Matt?
Yes, it will.
Venetoclax?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's being looked at in a doublet form in a very large study that's going to open soon in Europe called CLL18, which is looking at pirtobrutinib venetoclax versus venetoclax obinutuzumab, a very strong control arm. So I think that's a great study. We'll also see data emerging from triplet-based approaches. We saw a little bit of that from the MD Anderson study of pirtobrutinib venetoclax and obinutuzumab, or PVO, triplet therapy for frontline CLL. Looks very promising, but very early as well.
Yeah, I want to see the patient-reported outcome for the first few weeks of therapy comparing venetoclax obinutuzumab to pirtobrutinib venetoclax. Sounds to me like, first of all, it's all oral. You're debulking with pirtobrutinib as opposed to CD20 or obinutuzumab, which can cause all this problem. I would think patients would be a lot happier, but you tell me.
Yeah, I agree. I think strategies that are able to get around the using of obinutuzumab, particularly early on, to minimize those risks early on of infusion reactions and the long infusions and so forth, they think all oral regimens are going to be great in CLL if they can be time limited.
Want to hear a case from the best chat room in the world? This is from Venue. I brag about our chat room. They're incredible. I mean, they just think about what we're saying and boom, here it is. 71-year-old woman, SLL treated with obinutuzumab venetoclax 9 years ago. 9 years ago. That's interesting. Wow. And then got ibrutinib and zanubrutinib, but developed severe arthralgias after 6 months on both agents to the point where she couldn't move, was hospitalized, and both medications had to be discontinued. Arthralgias. Now she comes in with progressive disease. Pertobrutinib or venetoclax or ven alone. And also, yeah, I guess the real question is, what do you think you'd see with arthralgias? I guess you could try it and see, but any thoughts about pertobrutinib in this situation?
Yeah, I mean, this must have been a patient on one of the original trials of venetoclax obinutuzumab.
Yeah, really.
It wasn't available nine years ago, but with a nine-year remission.
Well, this is what you got to expect. This is what's going to happen, though, you know? This is what we're talking about. It's those people treated 9 years ago are starting to cycle in. All the people that I heard last week, they all had COVID and all that. They're five-year veterans. These are the nine-year veterans.
I mean, this patient to me seems like a prime candidate to have retreatment with venetoclax obinutuzumab. They had such a great response initially, and now they're having trouble with BTK inhibitors. So that would be my preference. If for some reason they couldn't tolerate the venetoclax and obinutuzumab, then I think a different BTK inhibitor would be reasonable to try. I might try pertobrutinib if they've already tried ibrutinib and zanubrutinib.
What about acalabrutinib?
Or acalabrutinib. Yeah, I think any of those would be reasonable to try because, you know, there really are just idiosyncratic reactions to these different drugs. And if one is not tolerable, another one might be.
All right, here we go with our rocket round of cases. We'll see how many of these we can get through. I'm going to start out with one of the common questions that we get from oncologists. And this harkens back to the original patients who got started on ibrutinib. Here's Dr. Brenner.
This is a 70-year-old patient who was diagnosed about 10 years ago. He had a trisomy 12. We monitored him for a while, but about 2 years later required therapy due to progressive anemia, splenomegaly. He also at that time had additional cytogenetic abnormalities, including a 17p deletion. And in this patient, we started him on ibrutinib, but he was tolerating it fine. But I was co-managing him with a CLL national expert who actually recommended switching him to acalabrutinib to really lower the risk of cardiac toxicity. And we did that in October of 2022. So my question for the clinical investigators, and I think this is a practical question, is in patients who are tolerating ibrutinib, do you ever switch to one of the newer generation agents to lower the risk of cardiac toxicity? And we know from some of the studies that have come out over the years, especially in the era of COVID, and there's also patients who have sudden death on BTK inhibitors that are probably, you know, cardiac events and potentially ventricular arrhythmias. And those certainly may be higher with ibrutinib compared to acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib. So it's interesting to know whether it's important to switch patients, even if they're tolerating therapy well, to lower the risk of cardiac issues.
So, you know, that idea of living a normal life expectancy of dying in your sleep sounds good, except if you're on a BTK inhibitor or you're on ibrutinib and you wonder whether you contributed to that. We actually had a case like that we presented along the way. Any thoughts about this strategy of switching, even though they're doing well?
So my approach, and I think probably most of my colleagues, is actually not to switch patients who are doing well, because mostly at this point, we haven't started patients on ibrutinib in a few years. So any of our patients now have been on ibrutinib 3, 4, 5 years already. And so you've kind of selected out those patients who are not going to tolerate it well. When you look at the trials, most of those more serious cardiac events were in the first 1 to 2 years. Now, if you are in practice and you've just recently started a patient on ibrutinib a year or two ago, then that risk is still there, particularly if there's other comorbidities. So that might be a patient I would switch. But for a patient with longstanding good response to ibrutinib, I generally do not switch them because you never know. You switch them to acalabrutinib and then they get a significant headache, or you switch them to zanubrutinib and they're having issues with neutropenia and infections. You know, all these drugs do have slightly different risks.
So, yeah, Ajith wants to know about the Amplify data. Yeah, you got it. That's exactly it. Yep. That's what we're getting there. That's what we're talking about. Let's just take a look back at the survey, though. Again, we've been asking these questions for years. One of the things I noticed, it kind of depends on who you ask. If you ask people who are involved with the combination programs, they'll start talking about, if you take away regulatory issues, they'll start talking about combinations for unmutated disease, period. but I think not so proactive group here, or like say a more traditional group. In any event, we picked the age of 70. You could call that young for CLL, I guess, but it's not 55 either. In any event, so we said unmutated disease, no DEL17P or T53, and most people prefer time-limited therapy in a 70-year-old. And then we say, suppose they have DEL17P or P53, and now we're all about BTK. When we make it a mutated case, it's really not that much different, at least nowadays. Any thoughts about what your colleagues are saying here? What do you think we would have heard if we made the age 55? And what about the issue of BTK, specifically Acala plus Abin?
So yeah, I don't see here. Right. The younger the patient, the more likely I think myself and my colleagues are to recommend a time-limited regimen. You know, just as we kind of chart out the course of a CLL journey over decades, you know, using intermittent therapies allows us to retreat and gives us kind of more options down the road rather than starting a continuous treatment where we know patients will progress on therapy. One thing to highlight here, I'm a bit of an outlier for the with deletion 17P TP53 mutation. The reason why I said venetoclax here is because this patient has mutated IGHV, and there's emerging data now suggesting that when you have mutated IGHV, you kind of behave more like a typical mutated IGHV patient, not like a patient with deletion 17P. And so I would give this patient a chance at time-limited therapy with venobin.
Yeah,
whereas in this case, it's unmutated right. IGHV, so that's why I said zanubrutinib.
So I always love asking these questions. I'm about to show you a slide where we have not asked this exact question, or at least not plotted it. But when you look at it, kind of interesting.
Pretty consistent, I think, across most of the investigators. Most of us really do favor time-limited therapy for the younger patients.
I mean, you don't think old people want to get off treatment too? Or they just like take the pill, I don't want to go through all the stuff with the Abin and all.
Exactly. And also, you know, they might be taking 4, 5, 6 pills already. What's another pill to add? The young patient, this might be their very first medication they're going on. It freaks them out.
I can relate. All right. 76-year-old man, here we go. We're going to start getting into what amplify may or may not mean. But this is a patient with relapse disease. This is a patient who she's actually worried that maybe maybe at some point she might need therapy. But anyhow, DEL17P, here's the case.
I have a 76-year-old guy who was originally diagnosed with mantle, or we'll say in quotes, mantle cell lymphoma in 2019. He was sent to a tertiary care center for a second opinion. He had a repeat bone marrow biopsy and was ultimately told that he didn't have mantle cell lymphoma. He had atypical CLL, and he was treated with ibrutinib, 420 milligrams daily, from June of 2019 until December of 2021, when he developed disease progression as evidenced by worsening symptomatology and mostly pancytopenia and anemia. And he had a repeat bone marrow examination, which confirmed disease relapse. So ibrutinib was discontinued and he was switched to obinutuzumab and venetoclax, which he got and completed recently. And I just saw him. He seems to be fine. He doesn't have any long-term toxicities, but I do worry, given his disease biology, that he will at some point progress. And so, you know, I'm always sort of thinking about what I will do for him should that happen. And so I was curious to know if on disease progression, would this be the type of person who would be a candidate for CAR-T?
So after we did a program with Dr. Michael Wong from MD Anderson last year on mantle cell, and after I was done with that, I was thinking maybe you all are going to end up in the same place. I mean, he wants to give Acala and Abin up front and bring in venetoclax in younger people, so maybe that's where you're going to end up. But could you, this has been a, you know, long-standing dilemma, and you don't hear too many cases where it's actually missed. Can you talk about the overlap between mantle cell and CLL and what the pitfalls are in a misdiagnosis?
Yeah. So, I mean, some of the clues that it's CLL are the CD23 positivity, which is rarely seen in mantle cell lymphoma. There's some other markers like LEF1 and CD200, which are more indicative of CLL. But really, I think in practice, one of the easiest ways to distinguish them is to make sure you send on the FISH panel a translocation 11-14 probe. That's the IGH cyclin B1 translocation. And so that really can rule out mantle cell lymphoma. Or if you have a lymph node biopsy, you can stain for cyclin D1 to make sure that's negative. So those are kind of the key points to distinguish pathologically, because clinically, sometimes an aggressive aggressive CLL can really look very similar to mantle cell.
So here's some interesting responses from your colleagues. First of all, the question of a first-line treatment, whether or not they would use a BTK inhibitor with venetoclax. As I've said in previous surveys, we've had some people talking about wanting to do it now based on the data. Interestingly, when you ask this group, almost everybody, well, most people already have used BTK and venetoclax and have not used the triplet. What kind of situations right now have you used this combination outside of a trial?
So I have had a couple of patients over the last year or so who have been really interested in the idea of a time-limited therapy, but they didn't want infusions. And so really what that leaves us with right now is ibrutinib plus venetoclax, which is a labeled regimen in Europe. So it's fully approved by the EMA, but actually did not receive approval here in the US due to some of the safety concerns around ibrutinib. So it's something I would consider for a young, fit patient who doesn't have any cardiovascular comorbidities. But I'm very excited that hopefully very soon we'll have a different time-limited all-oral regimen that I think we're going to talk about now.
So as is many times the case, it's a press release that gets us all excited. This one came out at the end of July. As Ajith referred to, it's so-called AMPLIFY trial, the phase 3 study with a positive result. Can you talk about sort of the historical background to the study? Of course, we don't have the data. This is what you're saying you think maybe is going to hopefully get presented at ASH. But can you talk about the study, what we know right now?
Yeah, so I mean, we've had a lot of data now over the years, many different studies looking at ibrutinib plus venetoclax, but we haven't had any doublet data for acalabrutinib venetoclax at all. Since 2018 or so, we've been working on our own investigator-initiated trial at Dana-Farber of this triplet, acalabrutinib, venetoclax, obinutuzumab. And so kind of growing out of this experience, the AMPLIFY study is now comparing this triplet to an AV doublet with a control arm of chemo immunotherapy, which was chosen at the time now several years ago because it was the established standard of care. So this was designed as a registrational trial. We've seen that the press release is positive, and so I think it's likely to lead to FDA approval of the AV doublet and possibly also the AVO triplet. And based on the timing of the press release, it seems like a possibility it could be ready for presentation at ASH. So I think this is coming soon, most likely as a new approved regimen. And then we'll have exactly what I was describing before, which is an all-oral time-limited regimen with the AV doublet. And then we'll also have a triplet regimen likely with the AVO. And I think that's going to be an interesting question of who do we use triplet for and who do we use doublet? And I think that's going to really be informed by the details in terms of the AMPLIFY study and what the data look like.
So, you know, I love patient-reported outcomes. I was just fantasizing about my patient-reported outcomes as we talk to the patient over the first few weeks or few months of therapy, because it seems a lot more pleasant to think about a acalabrutinib orally debulking somebody and then getting venetoclax than obinutuzumab, either whether it's going to be in this triplet or, you know, with venetoclax. What's your thought about that? I assume we know BTK will debulk them fine, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's really been the experience in the early phase studies so far. I'll highlight one other phase 3 trial that's ongoing called MAGIC, which is actually directly comparing AV to Ven-Obin. And, you know, I think in that study, we're really going to understand some of these things you're describing, infusion-related reactions, risks of tumor lysis syndrome. How do those differ when you start with obinutuzumab, as is the current standard, and then add venetoclax, versus doing a two-month lead-in with acalabrutinib, as is done also here in AMPLIFY, and then coming in with venetoclax. I agree with you. I think starting with those first couple months of a BTK inhibitor is really going to effectively debulk the patients, reduce those risks of TLS and other reactions. And so I think it's a great regimen that's in development now.
Yeah, one of the videos we didn't show today, we'll show in another one, Dr. Rupart talks about the shakes and bakes of anti-CD20 therapy and how distressing it is for infusion nurses. Well, one other thing we did ask about, we'll talk more about later, is CAR T therapy. Any thoughts about CAR T right now, and particularly the issue of would you use pirtobrutinib as an prior to CAR T as a bridge? Would you use pirtobrutinib first and then go to CAR T? Any situations where you go to CAR T first?
So we did just have the first CAR T product approved for CLL specifically about 6 months ago now, which is liso-cel. And, you know, it is now available. I would say I've had this conversation now with a few patients. It's the double refractory patients, post covalent BTKI, post BCL2 inhibitor. And, you know, as you explain the logistics of CAR-T and the risks and also the somewhat underwhelming efficacy data, CR rates around 18%, I've had patients so far choosing pirtobrutinib where you see that high response rate, 80%+. So I kind of see this as probably most patients opting for pirtobrutinib first, but maybe at the first signs of progression on pirtobrutinib, trying to pivot and move quickly to CAR-T cell before the disease burden grows too much. The other part of your question around, is there a situation where I might go to CAR-T first? I could imagine in a young, fit patient with high-risk genetic markers where they've already been now double refractory to covalent BTKI and the BCL-2 inhibitor, maybe going to CAR-T at that point. It's certainly a very reasonable option for a younger patient.
Well, I got to ask you about bispecifics. We got started. I don't have any slides on it, but just tell me about EBCO. It sounds like maybe that might have some activity.
Yeah, so epcoritamab, the CD20, CD3 bispecific, approved in some other lymphomas now, including large cell lymphoma and follicular lymphoma. Very early days in CLL, there's a study of 23 patients that's been presented so far, not even published yet. And this was mostly a double refractory population. And like with CAR-T, we kind of assumed we would see, you know, 18% CRA with an immune-based therapy. But again, small numbers, but about a third of patients achieved a CR with EPCO monotherapy. So that was really encouraging. Obviously, we want to see larger patient numbers. We don't know as much about durability yet, but it's intriguing to see that signal and may suggest that by approaching immune-based therapy in CLL with a bispecific antibody, perhaps we'll see better results than we're seeing so far with CAR-T.
And maybe even less surprising was they also saw, I guess, data with Transform CLL with EPCO. Is that correct? Which you might expect.
Yeah, that's right. And so that was seen at the presented at the EHA meeting this year, a slightly larger cohort, actually. And again, seeing complete responders in Richter's transformation. And those seem to be somewhat durable as well with relatively short follow-up. But it is a very intriguing signal.
So as always, I'm getting lost. I don't know. We probably won't go through half of this stuff today. I will say there's some great papers from Matt at the end, if we get to it, for you to check out. But quick question from the chat room from Dilip. Do you ever dose reduce BTK for fatigue or hypertension?
So I don't find dose reduction to be that effective for either of those toxicities. Certainly with ibrutinib, if I have a patient who's experiencing hypertension, I will try that as a first maneuver, but usually it doesn't work. So these days I would just switch them to a more selective BTKI. And fatigue I find is something that we see when patients are first getting started on BTK inhibitors as the CLL is kind of dying off. If it's a few months in already and they're still having fatigue, you got to look for another cause, because if the CLL is well controlled at that point, I don't think it's the BTK inhibitor per se that's causing the fatigue.
Hassan wants to know, do you see pirtobrutinib coming to first line? You see pirto-ven?
I do think it will get there eventually. I do think it's going to take time, though, because remember, right now we have confidence in the sequence of starting with covalent inhibitors, and then we know we can get a good response from pirtobrutinib. So I think one of the challenges for pirtobrutinib is, in addition to having to show very good frontline data, I'm going to also want to see some second-line data suggesting we can use covalent BTK inhibitors after pirtobrutinib. That would really make me feel more comfortable with that sequence.
Interesting. Okay, let's rock through a few more cases. 83-year-old woman, a patient of Dr. Rupard.
This is a woman who plays pickleball, you know, 4 days a week and is just active all the time. I started her on zanubrutinib, and she had a dramatic and rapid response. And once we got that CLL under control, she felt much better. She went to Florida last winter, and she came back about in March and saw me and looked great. She was tan and looked fit and was doing well. And then, much to my surprise, about 3 weeks later, I have a list on Epic that tells me when my patients are admitted to the hospital, and she was on the list. And within a few hours of that, my noticing that, we got a consult on her. She had been admitted with profound mental status changes. One of the cultures came back unexpectedly, showing that she had cryptococcal infection of her central nervous system. She ended up in the hospital for another week or two as they started her on dual antifungals, fluocytosine and amphotericin. So the questions I have for your faculty members are, first of all, what is their opinion on whether or not the zanubrutinib and the, by my way of thinking, fairly mild immunosuppression of causing a CNS fungal infection? I was able to find a case report of a patient on zanubrutinib for Waldenstrom's who had a cryptococcal CNS infection, so that certainly raised my eyebrows a bit. I'm also curious what they would do in this instance. You know, obviously we treat her for the underlying infection, but once that's cleared, this is a patient who really got a clinical benefit from treating her CLL. Would your faculty members consider re-challenging with either zanubrutinib or acalabrutinib or some other brutin kinase inhibitor?
Any thoughts?
So very unusual situation. We certainly did see some early opportunistic, including fungal infections with ibrutinib, but a lot of that came from the CNS lymphoma literature where patients were also on high-dose steroids. So in the CLL world, you know, we do see these kind of one-off cases, but we really don't see a signal of opportunistic infections or fungal infections with BTK inhibitors. So I think it's just bad luck in this case. And I wouldn't completely blame the zanubrutinib. I'd probably blame the CLL more hand because, you know, CLL really predisposes to all sorts of weird infections. And so I wouldn't be in a rush to get this patient back on zanubrutinib. Presumably they've been holding it while they're on the antifungal treatment. I might kind of wait till I start to see some signs of the CLL coming back, and then I would feel comfortable restarting zanubrutinib. I don't think there would be any point of switching to a different BTK inhibitor. But you know, it could be 3 weeks or it could be a year until this patient needs additional CLL therapy. So I wouldn't rush back into treatment. But once treatment is needed, I wouldn't necessarily wait till they sort of meet full-blown CLL treatment criteria, but I'd want to see some signs of the disease coming back before I'd pull that trigger on retreatment.
So again, I remember so many programs we did when the pandemic first came out about how you deal with COVID, and then when the vaccine came out, how you deal with that. Maybe a little bit of an update in terms of COVID today, both prevention, vaccines, as well as management of patient with COVID. I feel like almost a lot of these patients had COVID. Some of them had it 2-3 times. There's a lot of COVIDs in these case histories because, again, they're cases over the last 5 years.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, we see COVID now very commonly still in our patients with CLL, but the outcomes are vastly better than they were earlier in the pandemic. I can't remember the last time I had a patient even admitted for COVID-19, let alone die. So, you know, really with the vaccinations, prior infections, and now the wide availability of Paxlovid, COVID is generally manageable for patients. I do have some patients who've had really lingering infections that go on for a month, 2 months. So that can certainly be traumatic. So I don't want to minimize it, but I think for most patients with CLL, they should be mostly living their normal lives with, you know, relatively minimal precautions at this point.
So a couple more things from our survey. We asked in general what people prefer, and it's either Acala or Zanu or both, and everybody has their own reasons, and usually their personal experience in terms of efficacy. And most people, you say maybe zanubrutinib is more effective, I guess, based on the data you guys all presented. Tolerability. A lot of people, well, I guess it's a little bit split. Some people think Acala is better tolerated. So that's what happens when you don't have direct data for both of these questions. Any comments?
Yeah, I mean, this is really just kind of my sense from the data and my own experience. I am intrigued by that Alpine data that directly compared zanubrutinib to ibrutinib and showed an efficacy advantage. But on the other hand, I have a lot of experience with acalabrutinib. It's a very well-tolerated and effective drug. So it's great to have both options.
What do you think a study would show if comparing Acala plus obinutuzumab to Zanu?
So that has been modeled in some of these matched adjusted indirect comparisons, and it does suggest a bit of an efficacy advantage for acalabrutinib with obinutuzumab, but obviously you're then adding the additional toxicities with the CD20 antibody, and it's probably going to be a PFS benefit. I doubt there would be an overall survival advantage there.
So speaking of unusual situations, I'd like you to hear about this 82-year-old patient of Dr. Bacow.
This is an 82-year-old woman with a history of CLL that harbors deletion 17p and a p53 mutation. She was started on ibrutinib, and this was complicated by Stevens-Johnson syndrome and had to be hospitalized. She then was off of therapy and was being observed, but she had worsening leukocytosis and anemia. She had a PET CT scan that showed lymphadenopathy above and below the diaphragm. My questions are, would you feel comfortable initiating a different BTK inhibitor in a patient that develops Stevens-Johnson syndrome with ibrutinib? The other question is, given specifically for this patient that they have high-risk disease with a P53 mutation and the presence of a deletion 17P, should venetoclax be continued after the one-year mark?
Any thoughts? And of course, any other BTK inhibitors you might want to think about? Have you seen Stevens-Johnson's?
No, I mean, I've certainly seen significant rashes, but not Stevens-Johnson. I mean, it does scare me a bit to try another BTK inhibitor. You do wonder with ibrutinib, because it has some activity against EGFR, whether that might have been what stirred this up. But nonetheless, I think since this patient hasn't had venetoclax yet, I would lean toward using venetoclax-based therapy, even though we know that the PFS is a bit shorter than a continuous BTK inhibitor. But median PFS with ven-obin in a patient like this should still be around 4 years. This patient's already 82 years old, so you could kind of deal with that down the line, maybe even retreat with venetoclax-obinutuzumab and buy some additional time, and then save that BTK inhibitor for later. And obviously, I would use a different BTK inhibitor if I had to in the future.
So can you talk a little bit about your current approach to managing patients on venetoclax as relates to TLS? We pulled one of your papers. Let me see if we can find the title of for people. The so-called SAVE study, Safe Accelerated Venetoclax Escalation. So can you talk about the way you're approaching venetoclax at this point?
So I would say that what I do is maybe a little bit different from what I would recommend is done in routine clinical practice. You know, I think in routine practice, I do always recommend following the label for venetoclax with careful monitoring for TLS. We've used this SAVE approach, particularly for patients who wanted a more rapid venetoclax escalation. In this trial, we admitted all the patients to the hospital, and we did a daily ramp up of venetoclax for 5 days. So at the end of that week, they were done with the ramp up rather than the traditional 5 week ramp up. And we have not seen significant TLS. These are patients who get debulked first with obinutuzumab or other drugs. So it's something that, you know, we'll have out there in the literature. It's something you could consider using and citing our work. But I would say for most CLL patients, I think it makes sense to follow the label.
So let me get back to another case, and there are always problems that come up with people on therapy. This one is a 94-year-old man. I always love cases of patients in their 90s, such a challenging dilemma. This patient had CLL for 12 years and then required treatment and was treated with zanubrutinib. Here's Dr. Rupart.
I started him on zanubrutinib, 160 milligram dose given twice a day, and he had, you know, the typical rise, initial transient rise in his white blood cell count, but then had the decline well into the normal range, and his anemia and thrombocytopenia both went away. A concern that I had about him clinically is that his family practitioner sent me this picture that I've given you and told me that he had a pretty minor, you know, just kind of banged his hand against something while he was walking through a room, and he didn't think anything of it. But then 2 weeks later, it had become this pretty impressive ecchymosis all the way up to his elbow. And that was of less concern to the patient than it was to his primary care provider, but it was, you know, still something of note. So a couple questions I have for your clinical faculty. Can we tell our patients with conviction that the bruising is not indicative of the risk of internal bleeding, or is there some correlation there? Because I think that is kind of at the back of every patient's mind. I'm also curious if your faculty members have seen any clinically significant bleeding in their CLL patients on the Bruton kinase inhibitors. I seem to have seen a lot of bruising, Neil, but I don't think I've ever had a patient with any clinically significant bleeding, a GI bleed or anything like that on it. And I'm curious if that's been their experience or if it does sometimes manifest itself as GI bleed or frequent nosebleeds or, you know, even something, you know, more dramatic like an intracranial hemorrhage.
So any thoughts? We had another case I'm going to present to somebody else who had the same thing on both arms, all extremities, a lot of edema, et cetera. Have you seen cases like that? And how much of a problem is it? Do you have to stop therapy?
Yeah, I had a patient just like this, actually a physician in his mid-90s who had bruising just like that on a BTK inhibitor. So it's pretty common to see that type of bruising. It doesn't make me overly concerned. You know, the rates of any kind of bleeding on these BTK inhibitors are in the range of about 50%. So especially if you look at patients in their 90s, it's probably close to 100%. The rates of major bleeding are more around 5%. So if you're not using these BTK inhibitors that frequently, you may never see it, hopefully. Since I've used a lot of them, unfortunately, I have seen more serious bleeds, including a fatal GI bleed, a couple different CNS hemorrhages. So it does pop up. I don't know that it's correlated with bruising per se. So for this patient, I feel confident continuing the BTK inhibitor. If there's a concern, you can always dose reduce. It's actually a nice thing to highlight with zanubrutinib. It's 2 pills twice a day is the standard dose. So if you need to adjust the dose, it's pretty easy to go down to 1 pill twice a day or 2 pills once a day. You know, you can kind of move it around a little bit and see how things go in terms of bruising. And I think the lower dose, if this patient is already responding well, is a very reasonable move.
I'm still kind of letting that amplify thought sit in my head. Let me just throw something back out at you. If it plays out, I mean, let's not even deal with CD20. If, you know, we'll see what kind of benefit. But, you know, if it does play out that there's any kind of advantage for Ven plus Acala versus Ven plus obinutuzumab, like, who would you not want to give it to?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the tricky thing. When Amplify reads out, we'll have data on AV from that study, and we'll have other studies of Ven-Obin, but we won't have that comparison in the same study yet. What we will have is very long-term follow-up with Ven-Obin. We just saw six-year data published. With Amplify, the follow-up will be shorter. So I think you have those logistical advantages of AV. You'll be able to compare across studies and see if it looks like it's in the same ballpark as VO. But until we have the readout of our study, the MAGIC study, we're really not going to know how these two regimens stack up head-to-head. So I think we need to wait for those data to feel more confident about how to use these different regimens in different subgroups of patients.
Well, I'm happy because I love talking about CLL, because you could talk about CLL every day. No case is the same. I understand why you picked this as a specialty and why you guys have that center there, because it's just such a... Here's another great case of, you know, all these things that come up every day. Here's Dr. Battinger with a 79-year-old woman.
She subsequently started treatment with acalabrutinib a little over a year ago. Her pre-treatment white blood cell count was hanging around like the 15 to 30 range. And then basically 2 weeks after starting acalabrutinib, her white count goes up to 344,000. And I was away on vacation. And so my colleagues who were covering me asked her to decrease her dose to 100 milligrams. Well, she was held temporarily, and then she started taking 100 milligrams daily after that, which she elected to stay on because she felt better on the lower dose. So she's been on the 100 milligram dose now basically since that 344,000 white blood cell count 2 weeks after starting, and she's doing much better. Her abdominal distension, edema has all resolved. Her adenopathy is better. And so for all intents and purposes, she's doing okay on this daily dose. And so my question for this case is, if you can comment on the management approach to patients who experience hyperleukocytosis and other hematologic toxicities following initiation of BTK inhibitor therapy.
Hyperleukocytosis, I don't think we've talked about, at least not to this extent. What do you do?
Yeah, so generally nothing. What's impressive in this case is actually how much the change was. Often the white count will go from 100 to 200, but I think in this case it was in the teens and went up to 300. So that's a pretty impressive jump.
Almost 350.
Yeah, I mean, what that suggests to me is that there's a lot of CLL cells moving out of the lymph nodes into the blood where they're then going to slowly die off. And so to me, it suggests that the patient's responding well to the drug. There's really minimal risks of actual hyperviscosity or leukostasis or anything like that. So I really wouldn't have done anything differently. I would have continued this patient at the full dose. You know, and if the patient was having other side effects, like in this case, I think it does make sense to do a dose reduction temporarily. But I would say with Acala, unlike with Zanu, I worry a little bit more about the daily dosing with just 100 milligrams, because if you look at the PK of the drug, you're going to have a significant interval in that 24 hours where you're not covering BTK. And so I think it's reasonable to do some time period at 100 daily. But once things kind of settle out, I'd try to get this patient back on BID dosing.
So all kinds of questions coming in here. First, just a point of information. Daniel wants to know, how long was the duration of treatment in the Amplify study? Is that a year?
It's 14 months, 14 cycles. So it's a little over a year. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Susanna, talking about this hyperleukocytosis, brings up the issue of pseudo-hyperkalemia. Abdul says, when would you call BTK failure? Interesting question. And also the issue of TLS evaluation in the outpatient setting and how you manage patients, how you prevent TLS as an outpatient, how aggressive you are in keeping people outpatient as opposed to admitting them. And also Abdul says he had a patient who went from 99 to 250 after 9 months. This one sounds even more impressive, but can you remember all those questions? It's like a memory test. Okay. All right. So pseudo-hyperkalemia.
Yep. We can see it even at relatively low levels, you know, probably starting at around a white count of 100, you can start to see that, particularly for a patient like this where it's up in the 350 range. So there's a bunch of tricks in terms of, you know, sending different tubes down, using no tourniquet, withdrawing the blood, getting the blood on ice and getting it down to the lab quickly. So if you're seeing a potassium that's super high, you should always get an EKG just to make sure there's no changes, but probably it's pseudohyperkalemia.
Next question. When would you call a hyperleukocytosis? When do you call that BTK failure?
I don't really. Again, you know, I have patients who've been on BTK inhibitors 2-3 years and still have lymphocytosis. And as long as their lymph nodes have shrunk down, they don't have cytopenias and they're feeling well, I don't treat a number. I'm going to keep going on that BTK inhibitor for as long as they're not progressing. So, you know, I think for most patients within sort of a year or so, that white count does come down, but not everyone.
Dr. Kumar says you could check the plasma potassium. Interesting. All right, let's do another case. This is an 85-year-old lady, a patient of Dr. Brenner.
It's an 85-year-old female diagnosed with CLL around 2012. So my questions for the clinical investigators is, do they usually use a CD20 monoclonal antibody to cytoreduce an elevated white cell count prior to initiation of venetoclax to lower risk of tumor lysis syndrome? And do the clinical investigators believe that obinutuzumab is a more effective CD20 monoclonal antibody in CLL? And should we use it rather than rituximab, both in the frontline and the relapse setting? We know that the data with obinutuzumab and venetoclax is predominantly in the upfront setting and rituximab and venetoclax in the relapse setting. But it'd be interesting to know if they would still consider using it in the relapse setting. In patients who we've cytoreduced to a CD20 monoclonal antibody, do the clinical investigators still use the standard slow ramp-up phase over 5 weeks, or can we go to the full dose from the beginning in patients who have low white counts and no bulky lymphadenopathy or splenomegaly?
I'll throw in there, do you do anything different if a patient's still MRD positive after a year? Another memory test. Can you remember all those?
A lot of questions here. So I think his first question was around whether we use obinutuzumab before venetoclax to debulk and lower lymphocyte count. Yes, that's how the regimen was developed. It is challenging because the obinutuzumab infusion reactions tend to be higher as well in that scenario. So it's a bit of a trade-off, but yes, we do that. We can do this in the outpatient setting. Generally, as I was saying before, we recommend even after obinutuzumab debulking, even patients with normal lymphocyte count and normal lymph node size, still following the label and doing the 5-week ramp up to be safe. But we have, as I said, explored faster ramp ups, and they probably are safe, but it's not a labeled way to use the drug. The last question, I think, I'm not remembering now.
MRD positivity. Oh, MRD.
Yeah, so this is an interesting question and one that we're actually trying to tackle in the MAGIC study. So in MAGIC with Ven-Obin, at the end of the year, if patients have detectable MRD, they can go on to get a second year of venetoclax-based therapy. So that'll help us to understand whether that's helpful in getting more patients to undetectable MRD, eventually prolonging PFS. But as of right now, we don't have any evidence that prolonging venetoclax will extend the efficacy. And for all we know, it could actually cause resistance if you're exposing patients to that drug longer. So in the absence of evidence, I don't recommend treating with venetoclax beyond that first year. And he did have one other question that I'm remembering now, which is in the relapse setting, that's where rituximab is approved with venetoclax. But if you look in the NCCN guidelines, they do list obinutuzumab with venetoclax in relapse CLL. Admittedly, there's very little prospective data there to support it, but I would say that that's what my practice is, because we have randomized data now from the frontline setting showing an efficacy advantage of obinutuzumab over rituximab. Even some older data with chlorambucil-based combinations suggesting an overall survival advantage with obinutuzumab over rituximab. So even though that's an older data set, I think it is really suggestive of the power of obinutuzumab compared to rituximab in this disease specifically.
So I'm just flipping through some of the CAR T studies. We don't have too much time left. I wanted to get into a couple of papers that you had. Anything you want to say, though, about the use of CAR T therapy, and also how that goes, you know, in terms of how long it takes to get the patient therapy?
fortunately, in CLL, unlike the aggressive lymphomas, we usually have some time. So it usually does take 3-4 weeks to kind of do the CAR-T treatment. And most of our patients we can bridge successfully with existing agents. As we mentioned earlier, the rate of CR is relatively low at about 18%. But for those patients who do achieve CR, there is a very durable remission now past 2 years. So I think figuring out who those patients are ahead of time is really going to be key, and figuring out what kind of combination partners with CAR-T can enhance that efficacy.
So one of the things I see a lot of really interesting stuff in your bio, and I really encourage people to check out the slide set as a whole bunch of papers that Matt and his colleagues have done. But one of the areas that really is interesting, a lot of it looks a lot over my head, I'm hoping you can make it more understandable, is the issue of BTK resistance. We've heard a lot about that, C481S, and you had a paper looking at that as it relates to pirtobrutinib that I thought was really interesting. Maybe you can comment on that.
Yeah, so you know, we've seen clinically that pirtobrutinib is active both against wild-type BTK and the C481S mutations. And so in this study, what we were doing is actually tracking the variant allele fraction, sort of the proportion of the cells that have these mutations. And it was very interesting because these patients entered the study with pirtobrutinib having very high levels of BTK C481S mutations. And over time on pirtobrutinib, you can see those mutations going down. So those clones are being actually, you know, killed off very effectively. But after, say, a year or so in a lot of the patients, then you start to see a new set of clones coming up. And these are mutations like A428W or A428, T474, L528W. And these are new mutations, some of which we've actually never seen before with covalent BTK inhibitors. So it actually feels like a little bit of a game of whack-a-mole where you're knocking down that initial mutation of C481S, but then over time, a new mutation is growing out. And, you know, I think that's where the degraders are exciting, because they're going to have probably a whole different pattern of resistance. And so we may actually have three different types of BTK inhibitors, and we don't even know yet sort of what the optimal order is in which to administer them. So there's a lot still to learn here.
So, and you had this great presentation or data at the ASH meeting looking at more about resistance to BTK inhibitors. Again, like 95% of this is over my head, but can you kind of put it in, I'm not going to say layman's term, but I almost feel like a layman looking at trying to read this paper.
Yeah, I mean, here you can see kind of what I was talking about visually illustrated. So we had in this study 5 patients on ibrutinib in panel B there, and you see the mutations growing out, the C481S mutations. Similarly with acalabrutinib in panel C, you see those C481S mutations growing out. But then on the right, panel D, you see with pirtobrutinib, those same mutations are coming down. And then as patients progress, you see those new mutations in blue coming up. So it really speaks, I think, eventually to the fact that there may be relevance to testing for these BTK mutations in clinical practice. I don't think we're quite there yet, but I think we're getting there.
It reminds me of stories of using erlotinib in patients who progressed. This is why I was thinking about EGFR, progressed on osimertinib, that you get these, you know, I guess, mutations that develop evolutionarily, and maybe the original BTK. Is that a possibility here?
Yeah, I mean, there's some, at least preclinical studies now suggesting some of these patients, you may actually be able to eventually go back to ibrutinib, even if they were originally resistant to a covalent BTK inhibitor, and get some additional time, you know, responding in response to different mutations.
So one more paper I want to ask you about, looking at, we were talking about toxicity of pirtobrutinib. Of course, when we talk about BTK and CLL, we're talking about long-term therapy. What do we know about pirtobrutinib long-term? You were talking about cardiac issues. Like, how long have we actually followed people? I know you did this paper looking at people who'd been on more than 12 months.
Yeah, I wasn't directly involved with this work, but I thought it was very interesting because there was sort of a kind of question early on with the development of pirtobrutinib. You know, maybe the drug looks so well tolerated because patients just haven't been on it for that long. And so I think this analysis really puts that to rest, because they looked at 326 patients who'd been on pirtobrutinib for over a year, and you still see very low rates of high-grade toxicities. You see a little bit of arthralgias and bruising, as you would expect with a BTK inhibitor, but very low rates of AFib, 2.8% here in these patients on for over a year. It does look differentiated from the other BTK inhibitors there, and very safe from a cardiovascular perspective.
So, Matt, thank you so much for working with us today. Audience, thank you for attending. Are you updated on desmoid tumors for your board to retake again, Matt? Maybe you ought to check out what we're going to be talking about on the 20th. I actually spent an hour and a half with Dr. Gounder last year just talking about desmoid tumors, believe it or not. That's what's involved in being a general medical oncologist nowadays. Anyhow, be safe, stay well. We'll see you on September 24th. Have a great night. Thanks so much, Matt.
Thanks, Neil.